Welcome to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. I am your host, Henrik Johansson. I am the CEO and one of the founders of Gemba. Gemba helps entrepreneurs and companies to turn their great ideas into awesome new consumer products. Please stay to the end of the podcast and you'll learn how you can be our next guest on Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. Let's do it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Innovator Insights podcast, where we talk to successful entrepreneurs about their journey from the early days to building a product to eventually building a company with a real impact on the world. And today we're super excited to have Mattias Ehlenfeld with us. He's the founder of Voom Bikes, a company based in Austin, Texas, right here in our backyard, but has grown from a small company to now over $100 million in revenues all over the world, not just in the U.S., one of the fastest growing consumer product companies in the U.S. at times. He's also the regional cohort director for Better Than Giants program that we'll get some time to chat about towards the end. So without further ado, welcome Mattias.
Yeah, thank you so much, Henrik. We've been friends for a long time and really excited when I got your invite to be on this podcast to share my journey a little bit. Yeah, so really happy to be here and hopefully you'll send over not only curveballs, but a few tough ones as well.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, let's start with the beginning, right? Before we go into business and talk about Voom, maybe a little bit, you're an entrepreneur or an European like me, not born in the US. Share a little about the journey, how you came over here and then how you eventually became an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think it's both of us share a similar journey, right? And I think, other immigrants obviously also have their own journey. And for me, it started like in the early 90s. I was a very successful tennis player in Germany. You know, I grew up in the Boris Becker era. And so my parents thought that I would become the next Boris Becker and win Wimbledon, and that would be the big success story. It turned out to be a little bit different. I finished high school in Germany, and then I decided to come to the States to play tennis in college.
Yeah,
and I ended up arriving with three tennis rackets and a toothbrush at the airport in Monroe, Louisiana. Wow. And I ended up playing for the tennis team at college. And that's kind of how it all started. Finished up college pretty quickly because I always felt like I would go back to Germany. So I needed to get like an advanced degree, and I got my MBA at the University of Alabama. And because of the way that I showed up at graduate school, I ended up getting a job offer during graduate school to work for what's called the Productivity Center. And the Productivity Center was a program at the university that helps businesses in Alabama to improve their systems, processes. So it's kind of like a fun university / private business partnership. Ended up working there, and upon graduation, the company that I was consulting with or for actually ended up offering me a job.
And that's great.
Of course, because I'm a foreigner, I had to get special visas and everything else, but I was lucky. And I had my first job, and I was in Birmingham, Alabama, and working for an industrial company for several years. So that's kind of how things got started.
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, I got into SAP systems architecture and became a consultant with IBM. Then that kind of got boring a little bit. I started my own consulting practice, and I ran my own consulting practice, had various clients across the US, and so that's kind of how it all kind of evolved. So it was like sort of my hero's journey in the US, so to speak.
That's awesome. I spent a lot of time in management consulting too. So you started more of the corporate path, similar to me. And then what, you know, I guess starting a consulting business was not a huge leap from being an independent, you know, or being consulting professional working for a larger company. Right. Was that a pretty smooth transition?
Yeah, I think for me it was. In fact, it was kind of a funny story. I'm not sure who's going to all listen to this podcast, but I was working for IBM on one of my last projects. So, I was one of the last people on the project, and I started doing the billing for my client, and I saw what IBM was charging me for my clients. So, and I did a little bit of an arbitrage there, and I was like, okay, they're charging this, I get paid that. So I think there's quite the opportunity there. And So that's kind of how I all started. But, you know, I was such an expert in the field that and that space was so hot in the 2000s that I knew I was going to get projects. And it was just, I wouldn't say it was safe, but it was something that allowed me to kind of probably already fill my entrepreneurial bucket, because I kind of could choose which projects to work on, which mm-hmm. clients to work on, and I could start working on my own terms, so to speak, rather than working for a bigger company and them telling you sort of, okay, this is what this is your utilization, this is where you're going, this is who you work with. Mm-hmm. So it was probably more independence driven than anything else. Yeah,
that's awesome. But it was just yourself, you're an independent consultant, did you hire people, build a team?
Yeah, and fun fact, I mean, I ended up with Wilma, I ended up managing over 250 people. And this is something that I probably have never shared with anybody. But when I was running my consulting practice, I never wanted to really actually manage people. You know, it was not something that I wanted to do. So I wanted to have my freedom. And even in IBM, I kind of wasn't interested in managing sort of teams. But so I want to just run my own practice, be my own boss, and that's kind of what I wanted to do. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did Voom come about then? Was that after consulting or during consulting or what?
Yeah, I was super lucky that it all transpired the way it did. And then I think this is probably a big takeaway for some of your listeners as well who want to get into business starting something new. So I had already been in running my consulting business, right? So I could kind of control how many hours I would work during a particular week, right? Mm-hmm. I chose to usually work 35 to 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. Then in 2013, I'll tell you a little story how it started. I was working in consulting and I had my own projects that I was managing. And my brother from Vienna, Austria, he started Woom with his business partner, Christian, and they built one of the first bikes in their garage. Mm. And they sent it over to as a birthday present for my son, Luca. And as soon as I saw the bike, I knew it was going to be something special, right? Yeah. And then something interesting happened. My son, Luca, starts riding around the neighborhood. Uh-huh. And my neighbor comes up to me and says, "Man, what's Luca doing? What's he riding? He's having so much fun. I can't believe he's on this bike." Like, tell him just a little bit about it. And he says, "I want to buy one." Yeah. And I'm like, "Where can I get one?" And I'm like, let me call my brother, And so I called my brother and I said, "Hey, do you think you can get me another bike?" So he sent another bike over here, and I had sold my first bike to my neighbor, and he didn't even ask how much it was. Right.
Yeah, that's
so
awesome.
That's kind of sort of how it all started. So I unintentionally sold something, and that's kind of planted that seed in my head where I said, you know what, let's try this out and let's see how it works. And I was lucky because I was able to do my consulting job during the day, and I was able to actually create and run my business at night or on the weekends, right? Mm-hmm. So during the daytime, I would be working with my clients, and at nighttime on the weekends, I would be updating the website, emailing to customers, working on the bikes because I still had to partially assemble them, shipping them, going to events, et cetera, et cetera. So that was kind of like the first couple of years how it started. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And to your point there, I think that that is a, I think a lot of people do it, right? At Gemba, we see, I'd say our biggest category of customers are probably professionals that are starting a side gig at first. And
Right.
it's just a really good way to get things started and buy yourself runway rather than sort of burning the boats and just going all in from day one, because there's so much learning in the beginning of the starting a company, right? So if you, the
Yeah.
longer you can stretch your runway through, some other income, the better. So you
Yeah.
did that about 2 years, you said?
Yeah, I did this until 2017, so 3 years into it, but I really was burning the matches literally on both ends. I mean, my wife back then said, "Hey, I was like, is this really worth it? Like, why do you have to leave on the weekends? Why do you always work at night?" And it was really something that sounds really also good on paper, right? But it you really have to take into account the energy that you spend on both. And then at the end, I couldn't do, I had to like stop the consulting work because the business had gotten already quite big enough, wasn't profitable just yet. So whenever you run a business that's not profitable and you have income coming in from another source, it's really hard for you to like sort of stop that. So it was a very difficult decision for me to quit and make it a full-time engagement. Yeah.
And it, like you said, it takes, it's important to have a supportive spouse, because it is long, long hours and a lot of work, and initially for very little return, that builds
Right.
over time. So you need someone that understands you and buy into that vision.
Right. Yeah.
So was your brother the sort of the inventor, the original product development guy, or?
Yeah, let me just go back a little bit. So Christian Betzdecker, who is from Vienna, Austria, he was the one who had the idea and the concept of designing and developing the womb bikes, right? And just for your audience, womb bikes are bikes that are specifically designed for children of all ages, right? So it's from 18 months all the way to 12, 13 years, specifically focused and dialed in on kids, right? And so he had the idea. He had the first prototypes, and then he ran into my brother in Vienna, and they started Womb Bikes in 2013. So that all started over there. And then, as I mentioned earlier, my brother Marcus just decided to send one of the first bikes that he built in the garage, literally in the garage of his house. He sent it over to me, and so that's how it sort of all started. And I just thought that, I'm going to just piggyback on that and see if it works, right?
That's awesome. So at that point in time, they were making, manufacturing the bikes in Germany, sort of themselves.
Yeah, in fact, the first bikes were made in Europe, actually. And so they were still, because it was a very small batch, they also didn't know whether it was going to work, right? So I think the first 200, 300 bikes that they made, they literally built and assembled in my brother's garage where he lived, because they didn't, they also just had this idea, right? And so it was literally just assembled and there. And so, yeah, first bikes were made in Europe. And then, of course, as we scaled and grew, we moved the assembly into other areas, right?
So 2017 was when you made the full-time jump. What did that look like then? Did you incorporate in the US and then start a separate company here, or was it the same company? How did that work?
Yeah, it was. I talked to my brother and Christian, and I said, "Look, let's go try to see if I can make this work here." So I started the pilot in 2014, and in the first year, so I created my LLC here. I rented a little bit of a garage up here on Bernard Road, and I sold first year I sold 13 bikes. Okay,
13, 1-3.
13. 13 bikes, yes, 1-3. And that obviously didn't at all align with the original business plan I had set up. So the first year obviously was, those were the hardest bikes I would ever sell. I actually remember the first bike I sold was to the person at the bank where I walked in and asked her if she if they could give us a give me a loan to buy the bikes that I would be bringing in to the States. So it was just all a lot of hand-to-hand combat and trying to get my products to customers because, you know, nobody knew the brand here. It's a completely new brand. Nobody really was aware of the product. And it's easy to start something, but it's really hard to create awareness beyond friends and family to actually build something and create something. And I learned that the hard way because I thought, Henrik, I thought this was going to be easy. I have a the best product on the market. You know, I got a great brand. You know, I this is going to be a slam dunk. But guess what? I sold 13 bikes the first year, so it wasn't quite the slam dunk.
Do you remember what your projections were? What your goal was that year?
Yeah, I mean, I had a container of like 400 bikes, so I wanted to sell the 400 bikes the first year. But things were also delayed, right? Because you know, this is interesting, Henrik, because we're talking about products here. I found out the hard way that the bikes that we were selling in Europe, even though they're perfectly designed and developed everything else, but those were actually not compatible with the regulations that we have in the United States. So as I'm doing more research and everything else, we were already doing the production for the US. I found out that there's these regulations that I sort of overlooked, and so we had to retroactively reconfigure the bikes to actually match the regulations that were here in the United States. And so that was a big deal. So that's the big learning for us. Fun
But you caught
fact.
it. You caught it before you got the container of the bikes. You're able to
Yeah,
adjust before.
and some of the stuff we had to reconfigure here, you know, because you can't ship something to a customer, obviously, that doesn't meet the CPSC regulations, right? So same with the helmet. Like the helmet we sell in Europe, we can't sell here in the States because they have different regulations and different testing requirements. Doesn't mean the helmet there is not as safe as it here is here. I mean, you know the whole spiel about that. Yeah, so certainly there's been a lot of learnings early on in terms of, you know, because I'd never really been in the space of selling a product, right? And so for me, all that was new, right? Website, products, compliance, packaging, shipping, logistics, all of that was all new for me.
It's a lot of moving parts. And we see that, every day too. Again, with like a lot of people come in with a great idea. They maybe even have a great design, and they're, building the product, which, you have to build the product first, otherwise you don't have anything to sell. But there's a lot to think about, just like you said, the logistics, the compliance. We have a lot of folks coming to us with ideas about medical devices, and we have to like, all right, you have to really think through this first. Like you said, if it's children's involved, there's a lot of regulations around that. So how do you have any advice to early stage entrepreneurs like that? You also have to make sure that you don't get too bogged down in that, right? I mean, as an entrepreneur, you have to move fast. You have to get something to market. You have to prove demand. You can't spend $100,000 on regulatory stuff. You can't, most entrepreneurs at least can't afford that. Do you have any insights on how to balance that in the early days?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really it's a really interesting question because I think you need to rely on your gut a little bit, on your intuition. Because I think if you go of course medical devices is one thing, right? If it's also around like bikes for children, particularly there is a segment for under 3 years, it can't have small parts and everything else. So there's some topics which could, if they've obviously there's some problems that could result in some big punitive situations. I think it's a gut, rely on your gut instinct. Don't try to index too much on being super compliant versus being super chill about things, right? Fine, use a common sense approach to that. But be mindful of what really is it moves the needle, right? I think it would be sort of my advice. I know that's a little bit vague, but I would probably say, especially here, how we deal with punitive situations, I would probably err on the side of caution, because we actually ended up having a recall on one of our helmets, and we had to recall like 5,000 helmets at one point, right? This was in 2017. This was a situation where we tested the products exactly in accordance with the US law. It passed it through the testing facility. Everything was good. We knew the helmets were good. And then Consumer Reports bought some helmets, tested it in their lab, right? And it failed in their lab. And so we're like, we can't duplicate this in any. So what I'm saying is, we did everything we could, but maybe we should have done even more to accommodate for the margin of error in those test labs, so that we don't get into these situations where, you know, where something is getting tested in a slightly different format, and all of a sudden our products don't pass it, right? That was just one very tactical example. So my recommendation there is, with a helmet, obviously it's a big deal. It's a big safety topic. So maybe look at that, and maybe over-engineered a little bit more to account for marginal error during the testing process.
Yeah. I think that people should at least do enough research to understand what kind of risk they're taking on, right? And then they can make an educated decision on, all right, this is, like you said, helmets, massive risk. Some kid hurt themselves, you know, God forbid, that's the last thing you want to happen. Then maybe the bikes, you know, maybe a little less risk, but still a fair amount. And it's a minefield, but yeah, that's what we recommend to our customers. Do the research at least, have a complete understanding, and then make an educated business decision.
Right.
It's like working with a lawyer, right? They always kind of propose all these different things to put in your contract to completely protect yourself. And sometimes it's just not business reality. Your customer never going to sign that agreement. So you have to take the recommendation, and then, to your point, trust your gut and make the right business decision.
And I think that the last thing I say for this is, you know, back in the days, I had to read 250 pages of regulations and actually match that to what we were selling. Nowadays, as we know, we have all these, you know, AI tools that makes us so much more, you know, so much quicker and more easy to understand. And you can use that to get ahead. I mean, I literally had to read every page, and sometimes these regulations are not easy to understand. So like, you have to actually, you know, like deep dive into it. And so,
they change all the time too. You know, recently, last year or two, we've been dealing a lot with tariffs, right? And that changes all the time. And today, any product importer's got to, you know, carefully look at that at the outset, because the cost from the factory may only be half of what it's actually going to cost to bring it into the U.S. particularly, right?
You're right. Good point.
It's okay, cool. So getting back to the path. So now you're full time. You're selling bikes. What was sort of the next, if you're to look at the milestones, what happened after that?
Yeah, I think you know, I started earlier saying that I, you know, sold those 13 bikes in the first year. You know, the second year was 1,500, right?
Oh, wow.
So I moved from 18,000 in revenue to 500,000 in revenue, and then I moved from 500,000 to 1.5 million in revenue. Then I went from 1.5 to 4.5 million in revenue, right? So
that's incredible.
In 2017, I was running a $4.5 million business, but it wasn't profitable, you know? And because we are growing so much, I mean, I grew 300% year over year, right? And this product is highly, it's a big dollar value, right? And so what I'm saying is, it's very capital intensive, right? So I had to finance 6 months before I sold the bike. I already had to finance the bike through our supplier, right? So I had to put the money down, I had to put money and put the final payment once the bikes leave the ship from Asia. And so top of mind for me was, how was I going to finance all this, right? Yeah, and so 2017 was sort of that year where I was just telling the story to a buddy where I walk into my own home. Never mind, we're talking about a $5 million business. I walk into my house and the dishwasher doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
And my wife asked me, can we get the dishwasher fixed? And I said, no, we can't fix it because I don't have any money. And she's like, what do you mean you don't have any money? Well, we have credit cards, right, Matthias? And I'm like, they're all maxed out. There's no more room on the credit cards. So we ended up having to hand wash the dishes for several weeks. And so that kind of sort of was the story of, and you sometimes hear this, businesses grow a lot and they grow fast. Yeah, that's good success, but somehow you need to also finance that. And I had to be really creative on how to make that work. And because I wanted to continue to bootstrap the business.
Yeah. So how did you do it?
I literally put everything. Like sometimes, you know, you go to the casino, like, you know, you watch those movies where the guy goes in, you know, and they put everything on red or something, you know, or on 18 or something like this.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I liquidated. I mean, I did everything, Henry. Yeah. You know, I maxed out my credit cards. I sold all my retirement funds. I got extra loans on the house. And then I created, and I was becoming an expert in alternative financing. And I started looking at all the tools that are available, whether it's AR, receivable factoring, whether it's UPS used to have a program where you use them for ocean freight, they would finance 80% of the value in the container. And I used American Express financing. I used Shopify Capital, PayPal Capital, you name it. I was always highly leveraged, and I was always looking for the next tool out there. So that was kind of like the big story for me. But I was able to manage it, and then I also was lucky enough to build good relationships with banks. So I always paid my loans in time, you know, and so I built great relationships, and I got a really great SBA loan in 2018 for roughly $3 million that allowed me to build additional foundation in the business.
That's awesome. So you must have had an incredible conviction that this was going to work. Where do you think that came from? Was that just seeing the sales and the demand that?
It comes and goes, actually, Henrik. You know, at the beginning, the first 13 bikes I was talking about, like, I knew it was going to work because the product was so good, and I saw the kids on the bikes. I saw their smiles. I saw the parents' smiles. Mm-hmm. And every time a parent would be putting the kid on the bike, they would go to the park and they would tell others, right? So it was like we were like a love brand, right? But it took time for me to kind of get the confidence early on that that would work. And then as we were coming into the marketplace, you saw that love for the brand coming in. And everywhere you would go, like, you see a womb bike, you see the child having a great time. And we talk to our customers and they tell other customers. And so I knew it was always going to be a success. And so I had the conviction that it's going to work. And we never had enough bikes, actually, the first 2-3 years. We always ran wait lists. There was always like, just because you grow 300%, how can you forecast what you need in the next 6 to 12 months, right? Mm-hmm. You can't order too much because, you know, you may not have the funds to do it. Mm-hmm. And so there was always this incredible demand for the product early on, and that's what sort of like gave me the conviction it would work, right?
That's amazing. Good problems to have, though, as we used to say my last company, when you're growing really fast. And you know, it's so I'm sure a lot of our audience would say, well, go back a bit. How did you go from 13 to 1500? Can you talk a little bit about that, how you went from selling almost nothing to selling thousands of bikes and just
And this was 2014. I was really trying to find a way to create relevance for the product, right? And when you think back in the days, the whole social media wasn't a big deal back then. There was no TikTok. There was just a little bit. There was some Facebook, obviously, and there was a little bit of Instagram. I don't know, maybe not. But it was a little more traditional marketing. And the traditional marketing play back then was, how do you create trust and relevance for your end customer, right? And for me, it became very clear because you would go as a concerned consumer, you would go online to Google and you type in best bikes for kids or best bike for 5-year-old. And it turned out back in the days, there were a couple of online review community sites that actually were having very strong SEO. And so you would type in best bike for 5-year-old and you would always go to these two or three review sites. So I did that. I went, got in touch with the review sites. I sent them my bikes. I worked with them at night, explained to them why our bikes are different. They got the bikes. They're like, wow, these are the best bikes we've seen on the market. They reviewed them, wrote really objective reviews. This wasn't the affiliate marketing of today, right? Where you can't trust reviews. Back in the days, you could actually trust what you read. I mean, I'm generalizing, but for the most part. And so they would rank our bikes always as the winner in each age category. So when people were doing the online search, it automatically brought them to that site. They saw the reviews. I want the best for my kid because I'm a concerned parent. I want the safest, the lightest, the best bike. And then they would go to our website and buy it, right? So that's how I got traction early on. And the second factor, which we cannot underestimate, was, and I alluded to it earlier, is around the parent. Because if your child already is very successful on womb bikes, then on a womb bike, then they become fans, right? It's like they say that we don't sell bikes, we sell smiles, right? So the child is successful, the parent sees that they're successful on our bikes, and then all of a sudden they're telling other parents about the success. So it was really important for us to have really good customer care of those early customers because they would become my best salespeople, so to speak.
Those are two brilliant insights. Did those come easily, or is that something that you took years to realize that this is the secret formula?
Well, I didn't know early on what was going to work, but like when I saw the result, and this is my superpower, Henrik. Like my superpower is creativity and problem solving. Right. So for me, I had a problem statement. I need to create more relevance. So let me try out a bunch of stuff, right? And see what works. And then I had good discernment around what ended up working, right? In this case. And so, but also tried other things. I mean, I went on Amazon and tried to sell bikes on Amazon, and that was a good learning experience, right? Because Amazon back then wasn't a place where you can create relevance, right? Because you just have to play the marketing game and everything else. So I went to events. I spent so much time on events, hoping and thinking that if I would go out there, show a bike to a parent, they would immediately buy it. Well, turns out they wouldn't. So I spent a lot of time on events and sampling, and so I probably did more. I try to do as much as I can. And then figure out what actually works. And then I would double down on what actually works, right?
I think sometimes I see customers now coming in and they're just like focused on Amazon, for example, or there's a lot of self-professed gurus out there, and some are good and some are not so great, but it's sort of selling the idea that you can start a business as an Amazon seller, which I know a lot of people have been successful. I think it's harder and harder today, but
Agreed.
if you're really going to build a sustaining brand and company, I think you have to take the approach that you did to really understand your customer, to really see where you can find them, and not not just be a seller of stuff. Yeah.
100%. I mean, I think this is the big lesson learned for us, is that we are just not selling a product. We are a brand, right? And when you come to WOM, you know what you get. Our purpose is, and mission is to inspire millions of children to fall in love with cycling, to make the world a better place. And when you come to us, you trust us, we have to communicate these things. We have to message those things. We know early on, we knew every customer. Like, I had the phone number of every customer. I knew where they lived, the zip code. We sent handwritten thank you cards to customers.
Really? That's great.
Yeah. I had a form where every bike mechanic would sign a form and check the form, and we would attach it into the bike box, so the customer who would open the bike would know that the bike has been safely packaged and checked by Fernando or by Scott or whatever else, and they have that written certificate in their box, right? So there's a lot of things that go into a brand building that, unfortunately, you might not be able to do in the same way on Amazon, right? So
yeah.
I think obviously it's a whole topic for another day, right? The whole channel strategy. What is your channel strategy as a sort of a D2C brand? And it's probably one of the most divided topics, is, what channels you ought to be on, right? And it's obviously very industry specific and all that kind of stuff. But you're right. I mean, early on, Amazon was somewhat helpful, but it was really about us building the brand and building and communicating with our customers, and taking care of the customers was also extremely important. So when we would ship something to them, they would get the box. If something needed to be done, they would call me. Like, I was the customer service rep for the first 2 years.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the biggest mistakes I made was making my personal cell phone number the customer service number of WOM early on. But but they would call me, and I would take care of them, you know, because and if somebody would call someone at Amazon, they were just giving a standard answer. So for me, it was important to take care of the customer, particularly as it relates to the bike, because I knew if I take care of that customer, not only are they telling others about how great we are and how we take care of them, but they would also come back and buy more bikes, right? Because our repeat purchase rate is obviously built in. You have a bike for 3-year-old, 5-year-old, 7-year-old, 9-year-old, 11-year-old. So lifetime value is a big deal, right?
Yeah, that's amazing. And also, I mean, even if it's pain to talk to a lot of customers too, I can imagine the insights that you got from talking to them. Like, you understand what's not obvious, and understand what they like and don't like. I think a lot of, I think a lot of entrepreneurs make the mistake to not be close enough to the customer, right? That's where the truth lies.
I love that. That's really, really important advice, because you may assume the product works for you, but you don't know what pain points customers have, and they might not always reach out to you, or they may not even have the means to reach out to you, so you can actually capture the information. So that's why I totally subscribe to that.
Yeah, awesome. All right, I could talk to you for hours. So we've started out of time. Why don't you give us just 2 minutes on what's happened with Voom since? I know you've had tremendous growth, and then would love to talk a little bit about Birthing Giants before we wrap up.
Amazing. Yeah. So we obviously all know what happened in 2020. So I need to address the COVID situation. 2020, it was only 6 years in. I ended up finishing that year with over 20 million in revenues. And at one point we had over like 40,000 people on the wait list. So,
wow.
It's not like, we only could sell what we ordered to begin with, right? So there was no more plus or minus that year, right? So the bottom line is, like, I bootstrapped it within 6 years to 20 million. And then in 21, I combined my business with the business of the one in Europe into one, right? Remember my brother and Christian? So we put it together in 2021, and in 22, it was a roughly $100 million business, and I ended up becoming the CEO of that combined business and doing a lot of work in Vienna with the team. We had over like 250 employees at that point, still growing dramatically, battling supply chain issues and things like this. But the growth continued, and then have a really strong team in place right now. So we brought in a CEO to run the business, the global business, and I stepped away at the end of 2023, because I've been doing this for 10 years on, pretty much all in, right? And then also traveling to Vienna, Austria, pretty much every 3 weeks, while having my kids here in Austin. And so brought in a really strong team to manage the business. And we just wrapped up our year 2025 as the best year in Boom history, over 150 million euros. So that's roughly $180 million US dollars in total global revenue.
That's amazing.
Continuing to crush it. We just launched a brand new product here for even younger kids. That's our Boom Wow. That's a little bit in a new toy segment. So we're getting into toys a little bit around mobility. And yeah, great team. I have taken a step back, as I said, in 23, took a year off. So I'm grateful that I had the chance to do it, but I also needed it because of all the stuff that had all the things that I had to, do during the 10 years. I mean, any entrepreneur listening, running a business knows it only works if you're all in. So, and so I really needed to take some time to reset, recharge, and kind of gather myself a little bit, and took 24 off. And then in 25, I've started mentoring and coaching, and I'm actually supported SKU, the nation's leading CPG accelerator. I was helping other smaller businesses, just kind of getting back into helping others, other entrepreneurs, business owners, leaders, supporting them based on sort of like my learning and my findings. And I want to just give back. I don't have a desire to build another business right now. I had the chance to do it a couple of times, but my gut feeling told me not to. And so I'm happy to listen to that. And really now my purpose is to inspire others to become the best version of themselves. And so this is something I worked on for quite some time. And I want to channel this through some coaching and some advising and mentoring. Yeah.
Awesome. So I had the great opportunity to sit in on one of your presentations here in Austin just last week. So you're now leading the cohort for Birthing of Giants. Can you tell us a little bit what that program is overall and what you're trying to do this year?
Yeah, the program is specifically targeted for business owners in Central Texas who run a business between 5 and 50 million. So we call this the lower middle market business segment. And really the problem statement there is that, that the CEO of business owners, most of them are very lonely, and they're like the go-to person for all of the things that needs to be done. And so I offer a cohort where quarterly we gather together the business owners, and we're working on a very specific curriculum. And so we have a curriculum that is helping business owners scale and grow their business more profitably. So every quarter we meet for like a day, and we go through a particular curriculum. We have a speaker talking about that subject. And then I'll come in, help facilitate. We do problem solving. We're working on a 1 year from today, which helps us do a little bit of strategic planning. So think about it, Hendrik, as a way to work on your business, right, with other business owners who face similar challenges, right? And so you can leverage the cohort to work together and not feel lonely anymore. And then we're combining this with cutting-edge AI tools that will allow us to really give business owners some tools to really continue to grow and scale your business, you know, and really make it and create a business that is what you want it to be, right? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the idea around it. It's a 2-year program, and I'm leading it here in Central Texas. We're kicking it off at the end of February. So anybody interested in joining a cohort that really brings together like-minded, growth-oriented business owners who really want to move the needle forward and be surrounded by others, you know, other business owners that want to do the same thing. I think it's something that doesn't exist in the marketplace. And I have done the program in 2021. So I have been through the program myself, and sort of like, I'm not saying I'm proof of living, but mm-hmm. I've been there, done that. And I'm so convinced that it is such a valuable asset for that business owner that I'm going to do that now, and happy to do it and start supporting business owners. Yeah.
Awesome. So if people want to learn more, where to go?
Yeah, they can basically go to my website. It's, you know, we maybe can add it to the
to the
podcast or my email, matthias@matthiastx.com. And we have a website, birthingofgiants.net. So that's birthingofgiants.net. And that's a great place to get in touch with me, learn more about the program. And of course, I'd be happy to sit with anybody to go over the program and see if it's a good fit. I really want to make sure that I'm getting the right people in the room, right? And because that's really, really important to me.
Yeah. It's awesome that you're doing that. And I encourage every CEO, even, you know, on the outside, it looks very glamorous to be the CEO. But like Matthias said, it can also be a very lonely place because often, you know, you're dealing with stuff that you can't really talk to anybody. You can't talk to your team. You can't talk to your investors. You can't talk to your board. It's like, it can be a lonely place. I think it's super, and I've been part of several different networks in my career, and it's always so helpful. But to your point, I think it's important to, if you're going to join a network like that or a peer group, to find folks that are similar size or in similar space so that you have similar problems to address. Because otherwise, if you're a $10 million revenue company and there's somebody there that's, you know, $500,000 and you're different industries, the cross learning is limited, I think. Anyway, we need to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time. If we were to end with two things: one, what are you most excited about this coming year? And two, any final words of wisdom or advice to aspiring or early stage entrepreneurs out there?
Yeah, I think what excites me for this year is I have a very clear purpose, and I'm actually putting that into action now. So even though I said earlier I'm not building anything, I'm actually building my coaching practice. But it excites me to see my support and my impact with other entrepreneurs, because there's no reason why other people ought to make the same mistake that I have made. And just because I bootstrapped the 20 million doesn't mean that somebody else has to do the same thing, right? So I think it excites me to help other people. And the second piece is, the final advice is, I think this is a little bit of a soft advice. I think it's really important to listen to your inner voice, right? Don't try to compare yourself to all these other entrepreneurs and business owners out there. You are on your own journey, and no journey is the same. So make sure that you are aligned with your purpose, your mission, and your values, and stay true to yourself, because it's your baby, it's your journey, and that deserves the attention from deep down.
I think that's great advice. You know, there is no one way, to your point, right? And every business, every founder is different. So there's no playbook that you can just follow. There's certainly helpful to learn from others, but ultimately you have to build a business that's a a good representation of yourself. That's natural for you to run and lead. So that's great advice. Matthias, thank you so much for
thank
joining.
Thank you, Henrik.
Thanks for being a friend and for your leadership. Let's have a great 2026.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Henrik. You're awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. All righty. This is Henrik Johansson again. Thank you so much for listening to Innovator Insights from Idea to Impact. If you are a successful product entrepreneur or you work in a company that creates new products and you have an interesting story about how you developed your product and brought it to market and you would like to be on this podcast, please go to Gemba.com and click on podcast and you can fill out an application to be on the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you liked this podcast, you enjoyed this interview, and we would greatly appreciate if you would share it on social media. You can just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on socials. If you know anyone that you think would be a great guest, please tag them on social media and let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovator Insights. And would love to see your post and any suggestions you have to guests. That's how we find most of our guests, from suggestion from other listeners. We're regularly putting out new episodes and new content to make sure you don't miss any episode. Please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show and to mean a ton to me and the team. We really appreciate it. Do you want to know more about Gemba, me, or the podcast? Please go to gemba.com. and click on podcast, or you can follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I do most of my posts. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day.